Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Jules Pfeiffer, who discusses his new book, Explainers, The Complete Village Voice Strips, 1956 to 1966, published by Fantagraphics Books. In the weeks to come, we have Gustavo Arellano, Candace Bushnell, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Good afternoon, folks, and welcome to the Tattered Cover. We're really excited today, and a lot of our staff is so excited that he's back with us, to welcome Jules Pfeiffer to the Tattered Cover to celebrate the publication of Explainers, The Complete Village Voice Strips from 1956 to 1966. This is the first of a four-volume collection of the 42 years at the Village Voice. He comes to us today. He was born in the Bronx in 1929. Can I say that? Okay. I guess I did. There you are. He was waiting. He chose his career, or it chose him, when he was age five, when he immediately won an art contest with absolutely no effort or whatever. So he decided, he was a smart guy, and he decided right away he'd go for it. And what a good idea. He's a cartoonist, a playwright, a novelist, a screenwriter, and a children's book writer. And his papers have recently been donated to the Library of Congress. So I think there's an exhibition now, isn't there?
There was,
okay. So there will be again soon. Okay. Well, let's welcome him. And he's going to speak to us today, and then he'll take your questions. Welcome.
Thank you for coming. You know I was born in 1929. I would like to know if I'll be 80 in January. Is anybody here who's older than I am? Is there anybody? Who's the youngest person here? It's. I'm very good with the old fart crowd. And although I've been writing children's books for many, many years, I tend to draw people who knew me from my days of overthrowing the government, which I succeeded at, and you see what happened. So I'm going to talk a little, because the book is Explainers, and because the book, I'm not sure it was clear, is a compilation of my first 10 years at the Village Voice, and the very first strip into, I think, January 1967. With the work, basically, it was a on-the-job training, because I had no idea exactly how to do what I intended to do. I knew what I wanted to do. I just didn't know how to do it. And so there's a lot of scrambling around in the first year's work, first few months in particular, trying out different styles and different approaches, and all of which, as chaotic as it was, I've always been, I think, more comfortable with chaos than I have been with order or structure. Wasn't daunting to me. It was just exciting, a pleasure, and particularly a pleasure because by the time I got to the Voice and got in the Voice, I had been out of the Army from 1953, almost 4 years, had been trying to peddle my cartoons, satiric cartoons, in this period which was officially post-McCarthy America. Eisenhower was still president. But the atmosphere of repression was still so strong that, I mean, it was fascinating because what I live with, and this is in New York, the more, you know, one of the more liberal cities, the most liberal city at the time in the United States, is even there with my contemporaries, the young post-Korean urban educated, nobody really knew if you were a liberal or on the left that you had First Amendment rights. I mean, it was just assumed and taken for granted that you could have your politics and you could have your opinions. You just had to shut up about it except among your friends. So when you went out to a coffee house or a bar, you said pretty much anything and you laughed, and the drunker you got, the more rebellious you were. But when you're in the company of the grown-ups or at work on the job, you had to be very careful what political button you wore. You had to be very careful what you let loose among your coworkers, all of whom may have been very friendly and very nice, what you said. And I had my own experiences with this, because before I began to make a living, and it was years before I began to make a living, at the work I cared about, I had to work in a variety of art studios. And in these art studios, the people were always, they were just doing hack presentations of one kind or another for annual reports and slide presentations. And everybody couldn't have been more pleasant, and all of them were Republicans. I mean, you know, in a city that was supposed to be dominated by Democrats, I was one of the few Democrats, and certainly the only one identifiably on the left. I had no cohorts, no colleagues, nobody even underground who'd agree with me. So you learned to basically walk around, even in the city of New York, in that atmosphere, as if you lived in Eastern Europe under communism, but it was, you know, the politics were going all the other way. And when I took my work around, and at that time I wasn't doing strips. The strip is something I really created just for The Voice. I was doing these books, which we now call graphic novels, but they didn't have a name then. I was doing these long cartoon narratives. And the cartoon narratives were essentially political or sociocultural in their approach. So the first I did was Monroe, which was about this four-year-old kid who got drafted into the Army. And Monroe was basically, in every way, the forerunner of everything I was to do from that point on. I thought of the idea magically and amazingly after I got drafted, and I'd been in the Army a couple of weeks, and I understood this to be a terrible mistake that nobody would acknowledge. and in the hands of all this mindless authority, first of all, I never did well with authority in the first place, but when it was mindless authority, I did worse. And when it was authority, unlike my home in the Bronx, where I had parents who were always wrong, but at least they loved me, and they thought they were wrong, with the wrong things they said were on behalf of my own good. And I had teachers who were always wrong, but they were trying to help too. All of these people who were wrong and were almost always wrong were actively trying to help. They were just wrong. But in the Army, I met a whole cadre of people from top to bottom who weren't trying to help. They didn't care if you lived or died. They didn't care about you as an individual. They didn't even care that I wanted to be a famous cartoonist. They just thought I was some cog in a machine. And they treated me as if I was a cog in the machine. And unlike a lot of young men who were drafted just as I was and who put up with it, I couldn't. I mean, it drove me nuts. And through the 2 years I was in the Army, I essentially lost the power of speech. I was, like many Jewish kids in the Bronx, a wise guy. And I talked a lot, and I made jokes a lot, and I was funny. But this made no more an impression in the Army than it did on the girls I was trying to make out with. And as I became more and more anonymous in the Army, my whole sense of who I was, my whole identity as a wise guy, Jewish kid from the Bronx, eroded, and I was left blank. And I began to talk like a blank, and I found that I had thoughts in my head, and I tried to get the words out of my mouth, and I couldn't. I mean, they came out garbled or backwards, and except for the inducement of a drink or two or three or four, I couldn't speak. Once I had a couple of drinks, I was fine. But they didn't let you drink on the job in the Army. I might have been a much better soldier if I had. And through 2 years, I went through nothing more than the same average everyday humiliation that every other GI went through. But they seemed to be able to adjust to it, and it drove me mad. And in reaction, I began to think of ways of commenting. I mean, I had to figure out a way out of this two-year cul-de-sac where I was driven into, you know, underground and within myself and, you know, deeply unhappy and drawing from the time I was a little kid, and making up cartoons was my only way of dealing with my unhappiness. This was pre-therapy, before I knew anything about therapy, and they didn't seem to have good therapists in the Army. The therapists they had in the Army were the ones you went to who told you to adjust, you little Goldbrick. Because, like Army doctors, they were soldiers first and doctors second, and the shrinks were soldiers first and shrinks second. And rather than care at all or have any interest in you as an individual, it was how you fit in as a machine. That's how armies work. That's how they've always worked. It wasn't just the U.S. Army. It was every army. That they can't fight a war with Jules insisting that he be treated as an individual. It wasn't that I failed to understand that. I just didn't appreciate it. And as a way out of this turmoil that nobody was letting me out of, I began fiddling around with little satires. And I came up with the idea somehow of this four-year-old who was misunderstood and tried to convince the military that he was four, but the Army doesn't acknowledge mistakes. And, I mean, you know, the interesting thing about grown-ups then and now is that they don't ever admit they're wrong, or when they do, it's only with their back. You know, the best example in recent years being, well, we've had many examples. When Dick Cheney shot his friend, it was his friend who called up and apologized, if you remember that, because real men don't apologize. And real men, as George W. Bush will show over and over again, don't admit that they make mistakes. And the Army is an extreme example of this, so that when things were clearly nuts and illogical and screwy, no one would cop to it. And so I had no choice but to start writing about it. And once I started writing about it and began to formulate the story that would eventually become Monroe, but because this was a new approach for me and for most others, I didn't know what I was doing. And it took me actually something like 3 years before I could write this rather simple story. I understood as I was doing it that there are certain rules had to apply. And I had to make up the rules that went along. I realized that although I was angry all of the time and in a rage all of the time, this could not be a polemic. This could not be an angry book. That what I had learned in my years working with Will Eisner on The Spirit, first as his assistant and kind of a gopher, and then writing The Spirit, was the need to learn how to tell a story, the act of storytelling, and the need to entertain. I mean, as I was writing for Eisner over the years, I tried desperately and succeeded once in a while to propagandize in The Spirit and get some of my politics into the strip. Sometimes Eisner caught it, more times than not, and got rid of it. And other times I got away with it, and it was a game we played. But one of the things I understood, one of the rules I understood, is no matter how angry and how justified you are in your anger, you can't let that loose to the reader or to the audience. It can't be a polemic because nobody's interested and nobody's going to listen. I understood that if I was going to make this anger work, I had to transform it into and learn how to transform it into a form of entertainment. It had to be fun to read. And I had to seduce the reader. It had to be, in a way, and I learned this at the time, and I do it to this day. It had to be a form of sleight of hand, where you're, the magic act, where you're saying to the reader, or if it's a play, the audience, look this way while you're doing something else. And it's the fun. I mean, while you're doing this work, which you take very seriously, there's enormous fun at the same time in pulling the wool over their eyes, in getting away with it, the whole act of getting away with it, that you're not supposed to be able to say this kind of thing, but I'm going to say it because they won't know I'm saying it. I got away in newspapers for years in syndication who couldn't have agreed with me less on what I was saying. They just never figured out what I was saying. There were too many goddamn words. You know, who could read all that stuff? So, you know, I mean, as it was, I turned out to be the first a cartoonist in mainstream newspapers. I mean, any newspaper outside of the Daily Worker who was against the Vietnam War as far back as 1963. These schmucks never understood that. But my readers did. You know, on campuses they did. And the same thing with civil rights cartoons. They never got what I was doing, which allowed me the freedom to say things that you weren't supposed to be able to. But it took me years to figure out and learn how to practice this craft, both in the writing and the drawing of it. And since there was no one else doing this kind of work, certainly not in the strip form, and the strip form was what I was essentially educated and addicted to. I never had any ambition to be a gag cartoonist or a panel cartoonist or an editorial cartoonist like Herb Locke or later Paul Conrad or others I admired. And while I loved New Yorker cartoons, I couldn't think in terms of gag panels. I couldn't think in terms of a single shot with a caption underneath it. I was raised adoring the comic strip. And both adventure strips and humor strips, but particularly story strips, and was addicted to the form and studied the form, and I created my own private seminars in which I would collect all of the Labner and you know, cut them out, and all of Amy and Slats, another Al Capp strip that he wrote, that Rayburn Van Buren brilliantly illustrated. I clipped Terry and the Pirates. I clipped the Spirit stories. I'd study from panel to panel how these guys did it, how they told the story, what their influences were for movies, try to figure it out, how they built it up in terms of words and pictures. In this wonderful book that Bob Harvey, who's over here, wrote about Milton Caniff, a biography, he quotes Caniff repeatedly about something that all cartoonists knew and seems to be this arcane information from people, from the general public, which is that it's words and pictures, and that and it's the combination of the two, and that it's not that the words do one job and the pictures do another. There's only one job, and that's to tell the story, the combination of the two. And Caniff was one of the masters who taught me how to use words, and then suddenly silent panels and nothing goes on. And Eisner picked that up from Caniff. Nobody ever did it as well as Caniff. And on Terry and the Pirates, for those of you who are too young to remember. And you know, I always saw this from the beginning as, in essence, an art form before it began to be taken seriously years later. It was, I mean, there's something marvelous about figuring out, taking something that looks very simple and figuring out the very complicated structure by which it looks simple and feels simple and seems simple. And the whole trick in the work I did and the work others before me did was to take something that's complicated and make it look as if you're ice skating. Or, you know, the role model I used for years, the image in my mind, was always Fred Astaire, who did these impossible steps and made it look as if you could do it. Even I could do it. And Astaire was my model from the beginning. He remains my model to this day of making the art and the pic and the words combine into this simple act of storytelling where by the end of it, suddenly you're hit with a pow and you can't figure out how that was done. You know, and oddly enough, the influences over the years stem from something as simple as reading comic strips, like Caniff, who taught me so much in later years, when they collected some of the early Popeyes, the 1930s. Woody Gelman connected the first Popeyes, and I read Popeye for the first time as a serious strip when I was in my 30s. I realized that how brilliant it was and how artful it was and what a brilliant example of storytelling, and how Seagar, who was the great creator of Popeye, when he died in 1938, Popeye just became something else again. But how he told the story, how he kind of had a philosophical approach to his characters and to life in general, but he sneaked it all past the reader. It was all funny and violent and wonderful and great gags. And so there was Seeger on one end who taught me how to do this, and it was Samuel Beckett and Waiting for Godot on the other end who taught me how to do this. That when I, in the mid-50s, read Waiting for Godot and read the dialogue on the page. And there was virtually no dialogue on the page. It was just, he's coming. He's not coming. Yes, he is. He's not. When is he coming? And I, after a couple of pages, I thought, this is a comic strip. This is, I mean, Seeger could have written this. This is just, you know, and yet, as I read on, this simple dialogue had extraordinary resonance. And I couldn't figure out how these two guys discussing absolutely nothing and doing absolutely nothing could say things which enthralled me, which moved me, which, and I said, how do I learn to do that? How can I learn to do that in six panels? This is what I have to figure out. And so you find these mentors in a way, these teachers in a way, who never knew they were teachers and didn't go out to be teachers. And you find that you know, as an artist in your own life, by diverse influences in everywhere, from movies to novels to, in my case, to political columnists like I.F. Stone, who taught me how to think and distrust what government was telling me when everybody still trusted government. From Lincoln Steffens, who the great muckraker in the 1920s, who talked in his autobiography about how after his education he went out and got a job and realized everything he'd been taught was a lie, and how he had to unthink, and I had to learn to unthink as well, how to figure out from what they're saying what the code is, and decode for the people who would eventually become my readers what I was telling them here. You know, I mean, I saw that essentially after a while what I was doing in The Voice and elsewhere was decoding. This is what they say. This is what they mean. You understand now? And after years of trying to sell these books of cartoon narratives, beginning with Monroe, and then a book called 666, which was a narrative about conformity, and another book called Boom, which was about the bomb, I and all these editors all over the city loving what I was doing and telling me how good I was, but they weren't going to buy it, they weren't going to sell it, because I was unmarketable, because nobody knew how I was, and it looked like a kid's book and seemed like a kid's book, but it wasn't. None of them said it was too political, and I didn't think at the time, and I'm not sure it's true now, that it was politics that scared them off, but it might have been. But in any case, what became clear, as they all told me how much they loved my work, was that I had to find a way of getting into print so that I could get famous. I had to become famous in order to get printed. Because they said if I was only Saul Steinberg or James Thurber or William Steig, they'd publish me in a minute. Those were famous cartoonists. They were great cartoonists. I wasn't one among them because none of these sons of bitches would publish me. So I had to go out and figure out a way of becoming Steinberg and Steig and Thurber and whoever. And I saw on all these editors' desks copies of The Village Voice. You know, they started popping up. So I had never seen The Voice. I went out and looked at it. It seemed okay to me, but much more interesting was my naked and ugly ambition. And I thought, if I can get into this paper, they'll think I'm famous because it's what they read. So I went down to The Voice. I got in The Voice. I developed the strip, and I thought it would take 2 or 3 years before these guys would think I'm famous. It took up to 3 months, and everything was launched from then on. And I schemed my way into figuring out what the situation was, into how to simply get seen. And it's no different today. And if I hadn't had the Village Voice back then, the odds are I never would have been in print, and I wouldn't have ended up as a lousy art director in some bad advertising agency, having to make a living and being, you know, bitter and that it's not as if anything has gotten better. It's still just as hard to if you have something new to say, to get it said. And the only thing I've learned over the years, and the only thing I tell young people, is get a T-shirt and put on it, outlast the bastards. That after a while, they get tired of rejecting you. And if you keep coming around and coming around and don't go away and stay in their faces and don't give up, it's not that they feel sorry for you. They feel sorry for you, for themselves humiliating you. And they let you in the door so they can then humiliate somebody else new, so they don't feel as bad about it or as guilty about it. And it's a process that goes on over and over and over. It goes on to this day. And for young people who can withstand it, there can be a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And then that too can start turn into dross, and you have to start all over again. And starting all over again from scratch is an important part of the game. Don't let them ever change your mind about who you are or what you can do, and don't accept their judgment of you. Unless they're right, of course, and you never really know that, do you? All right, I think I better stop before you start walking out on me.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Gustavo Arellano, Candace Bushnell, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on September 20th, 2008.